This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. First off, I must apologize for not having an episode last week. My computer screen broke, and it took almost a week to get sorted out and fixed, and didn't leave me with enough time to finish preparation on this episode, record, and then edit it. But we are back, and today we are talking about the Imaginative Film Festival. Imaginative is the world's largest indigenous film and media arts festival. They don't just focus on Turtle Island, but indigenous tribes and nations from around the world. This year's iteration ran from October 17th to the 22nd in person in Toronto, and from October 23rd to the 29th online. We previously covered the festival back in 2020 on episode 130, Imaginative. Joining me today to talk about some movies is Jeff Ballmer, one half of the Classic Movies Live podcast, and someone who has begun writing reviews for ContraZoomPod.com. Jeff was last heard on episode 252, 2023 TIFF Wrap-Up. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me back on, and thank you for letting me cover this festival. We're about to talk about it for a while, but I wrote two reviews of movies that I saw at this festival that you can see on ContraZoomPod.com. Is that what it is? Mm-hmm. We'll get to
it. That is what it is. Yes, and they are in the show notes, so you do not have to worry about that. I'm going to make sure to share all the great things that you write. And it feels nice. I feel like, you know, I don't want to call you a part of the ContraZoom Pod family because I feel like you already have been for the longest time. We've done so many crossover shows together, but it feels a little more official these days.
Yeah, I mean, one of when people bring it up off pod, usually one thing that I tend to express is that I just wish that I could talk about movies to an audience more than I already do. But with Classic Movies Live, we can only put out an episode every week. We could do more, but that's actually too much. So I'm just always happy whenever I can be a part of other people's things as well. I like hearing my own voice a lot, and sometimes, and I listen to other people's podcasts more than I listen to my own too. So
we're all a little bit narcissistic to do this.
It's part of the job.
I'm curious, this was your first time attending the Imaginative Festival. I know you attended in person, something that I have not. I'd love to know about your experience with it.
This festival was really cool. For one thing, it was at the TIFF Bell Lightbox, which is, that's TIFF's main building. So it is one of the venues that they'll show movies at TIFF. But it was pretty small. It happened during TIFF, during the Lightbox's normal operation hours. So they did have, you know, one or two theaters blocked off for Imaginative, but they had other stuff going on in the other theaters the whole time. And like I was saying, it was a pretty small festival, but it was it felt very, very friendly. Like TIFF is a nice festival to go to. You meet a lot of cool people. People at TIFF are typically friendly, but this one felt small enough that a lot of the people that you saw at one showing, you would see them again at least one other showing. It really felt like a family. They had one person. I went to the opening night film, and one of the organizers, when she was talking at the beginning, she said, "I like to try and make a point of shaking every single person's hand that comes to this festival. So if you see me, please say hi, because I want to shake your hand."
Did you end up shaking their hand?
I unfortunately did not. I'm very shy.
Fair enough. One thing I find really interesting is the fact that it's not, as I mentioned earlier, not just like North American indigenous films, that it really is from all over the world. And I feel it's something that really gets overlooked when we're talking about, you know, indigenous cinema and artwork and things like that. But it's really interesting. I know we didn't really get a chance to cover a lot outside of North America, other than New Zealand / Tonga. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's, you know, films from Finland, films from Mexico, you know, from all over the place. So I find it so fascinating that this is the festival that's sort of the world's largest indigenous film festival. Did you sort of feel the worldliness of it all?
I definitely did, because two movies we're going to talk about, the New Zealand films, were done in Not just those two. There were a few other New Zealand films there, but they were put on in cooperation with the, I don't know if this is the exact organization, but the local Pacific Islander Society. And they were well attended by local Pacific Islanders. It's sometimes when you're in Toronto, even though Toronto is the biggest city in Canada and it is very multicultural, sometimes you forget that just walking around the city. Like everyone around you is just from Toronto. Which I guess is good, but like when I went to these movies, you got to see like an entire community come together of people from other places. Like all the people who were originally Tongan were at those Tongan movies and were living it up and really excited to just see themselves represented on screen, which was just such a cool experience. Definitely not something that. That happened at a lot of the larger TIFF showings I went to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll say when I go to film festivals and I go to see a movie that's in like a different language, you'll often notice that the audience does sort of skew more to that ethnicity or language speakers. So it's definitely very interesting to see that on a larger scale. And I have gone to screenings of Indigenous films as well, where the audience is mostly Indigenous. And so it's really nice that, you know, these groups of people do really show up for their people's art.
This is not related to Imaginative, so I will keep it very short. But when I was at TIFF, when I went to see the movie The Monk and the Gun, that movie was packed, and it felt like it was packed with every Bhutanese person in Toronto, to the point where the director, who obviously was Bhutanese, could make... I don't think he spoke. I don't think that while he was there, when they gave him the mic, he said very much in Bhutanese, but he could make jokes about Bhutanese culture that would get laughs from the audience.
Nice. That's really good to hear. All right. Well, I'll also preface this by saying we are two white dudes, so please take our reviews with a grain of salt in that regard. But we love cinema as a whole. And ContraZoom Pod, I feel I've made a very concerted effort in making sure that we are celebrating cinema from all parts of the world, from every perspective. And that's why I personally find it important to cover festivals like Imaginative. But yeah, since the festival is now fully wrapped up, awards were actually already handed out, and I'm going to highlight a few of them. Best Dramatic Feature went to Hey Victor, with Mama winning Best Documentary Film. There were a few different jury awards, including the Sun Jury Award, which went to Tautuktavuk, What We See, and the Moon Jury Award, which went to Cuckoo. I'm hoping pronouncing all these words correctly. And then the Audience Feature Choice Award went to Cafe Daughter. Without getting too deep into any of the films yet, did you have any thoughts on the winners?
Unfortunately, I was unable to see Mama or Cuckoo. I saw all the other winners, and I am generally pretty pleased with those, although I would say that... I will say that audience voting was... I personally got a little confused as to how it worked. I think they were trying a new system that was... that probably should have been very straightforward, but there was some trouble communicating it sometimes. I know that you could vote for any number of movies, and I didn't vote for a couple that I went to, not because I wouldn't have voted for them, but because I did not understand how to, and didn't understand that was going to be my only chance to vote for that movie. So anyway, that's just a little bit of... context on how difficult the audience award was to vote for. But I am very surprised to see that one as the winner, because that's one that I saw, and without getting too into it, it was not one of the better ones that I saw.
Okay, fair enough. But you said overall you are pretty happy with the winners.
Yeah, I guess with the audience award, based on a few of them, based on the movies I was at and the enthusiastic response they got, I am a little surprised that, you know, well, I guess they didn't, I don't know if they told which things would have been the runner-ups in that category, but there's definitely some where I would have thought, oh, that's going to win the audience award, and I guess a little harder to predict at this one. Although I will say I was not at the in-person screening for Cafe Daughter, so I can't really gauge the response there.
Fair enough, yeah. It's always so interesting when, you know, you're at a festival and you're trying to figure out which way the audience is going. And you're just like, yeah, I think the audience really loved it. And then you find out that, like, it doesn't even get an honorable mention in the audience awards. You're like, well, shows what I know. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, then let's kind of get into the films. We're going to specifically talk about four main ones, and then you have some thoughts on two at the end. But we're going to get started with I'm Just Here for the Riot, which was directed by Kathleen Jamie and Asia Youngman. And Youngman is Cree Métis. This film was actually also talked about on episode 235, Hot Docs 2023. So I'm going to kind of let Jeff take the lead on this one a little bit. But I'm very curious because this is a film about the Vancouver Canucks riot after they lost the 2011 Stanley Cup final to the Boston Bruins. I am originally from Toronto, so I remember watching it on the news and watching it quite intently and being bewildered by it all. Now sort of the Canucks in Vancouver hockey fandom is a bit of the butt of a joke throughout the hockey world, even in Canada in general, I would say. And you are someone who is not from Vancouver, but you lived a chunk of your life in BC, and now you're in Toronto. So you sort of get the reverse experience that I have. So I'd sort of love to know first, you know, were you here when the riots happened? Do you remember what was going on and sort of how that perspective has changed? And then we can kind of talk about the documentary itself.
So I wasn't here during those riots. So all of my, even my closer experiences with them definitely come from a bit of a distance, but this is one I was very excited for exactly that reason, because while I wasn't here in 2011, I came to, I moved to BC in 2013. So it was still very, very fresh on people's minds. And most of the people that I met while I was in BC were obviously very cognizant of the riots, and a lot of them had, like, it had really changed the course of a lot of lives, even, you know, even among people that I was close to who weren't necessarily directly involved. I have a friend of one of my friends, like, you just can't bring up that entire year to him or he will derail your entire night. I was very involved in student government, not actually in student government, but like as part of my student newspaper at university. And our student union president, briefly, it came out that he had been one of the people that was expelled from UBC for participating in that riot. And the reason that he was at UBC Okanagan was because he was just ineligible for medical school at UBC. So he changed his entire major and entire life and became not a very good student union president. I have nothing good to say about him, but this isn't a hit on that guy. This is just talking about how that changed the trajectory of his life. And that was a person that I was, you know, not actively friends with, but interacted with on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. I think then that kind of gives you even more perspective on this documentary, because a good chunk of this movie focuses on interviews with people who were either arrested or internet called out, I guess is the most neutral terminology I can use, mm-hmm. for participating in the riot, causing various acts of levels of destruction and things like that. So all that said, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on the actual film.
I loved this movie a lot. It was a really hard watch, but in a way where I kind of want to watch it again, because it, without ever saying it, it gets to the heart of a feeling that I just don't see in a lot of media, and that is really, really hard to express. Like, the thing that stuck with me most from this documentary is that everyone they interview, they're all very forthcoming. They're all, you know, happy to share what they have to say, but no one seems to really like their opinion. Like, they have their opinion. They have it. They express a strong opinion. They're not changing their mind on anything. But like, when you bring it up, it's so fresh that like, no one likes talking about it. No one like is super happy about what their thoughts are about the riot. Even the people that have the strongest stances of like, well, everyone who was involved with the riot should have their entire future ruined. They don't feel like they like saying that. They don't feel like they're going to change their mind, but they also just like would rather talk about something else.
Interesting. Yeah. When I watched it in the moment, I feel like I really liked it. And I ended up, you know, writing a review for this film and gave it 4 out of 5 stars. But I sort of feel like as time has gone on, I feel less highly about this film, more so because of what I feel they didn't include and the perspectives of narratives they decided to focus on. And it sort of left me feeling, the more time has passed, I feel more cold about it. So things like, I dislike that the movie was so heavily focused on the police side of things, including getting their interviews and sides of the stories, when I feel like the way the movie is presented was there was a brief moment before things totally got out of hand that the police should have intervened quicker to disperse troublemakers and things like that and sort of shut things down. Mm-hmm. Another thing is I really wish we got more of a perspective from the Canucks as an organization, because at the very first minute of the movie, we see a clip of Roberto Luongo, who is the goalie for the Canucks, talking about it. And we get like this 5-second clip of him. And that is all we get from anyone within the Canucks organization. Now, most people that played on that team are long retired. They're not even involved in hockey anymore. So I feel like they could have gotten some more people to talk on record about what this meant to the franchise, their perception within the community, all this sort of stuff that went on. And we get absolutely none of that. And then the third thing is, I feel like I really disagree with mob mentality and internet bullying and all that sort of stuff, but I think the movie sort of spends a lot of time trying to make us feel bad for the people who caused this destruction. And it's really hard to feel bad for them for facing the consequences of them, you know, losing their job or getting kicked off their sports team or being expelled from their university or things like that. So it's a very complicated feeling where I do agree people deserve second chances, and I'm glad a lot of these people have been able to rebound their lives and get back on track. But I think the movie spends too much time trying to make us feel pity for these people, and that pity just wasn't there from me.
I feel like, the other thing that, when I watched this movie, it felt really fresh. Like this is an event that's 12 years old at this point. I'm going to assume the movie was probably made throughout 2022. So even at that point, it was over 10 years old. And like, I feel like with a lot of these interviews, in a different movie, that would be like, this person's life was ruined from this element, no, from this event, or this person's life, you know, he had 5 years where he couldn't do anything, but then he sort of picked himself up after that. And it feels like this movie is sort of like catching people in the process of that. Like it'll make the statement that someone's life was ruined for their participation or non-participation in the riot. But it feels like that doesn't quite land the way that maybe it should, because someone's life being ruined over the last 10 years, we're still talking about like people who were 18 and who are now 30. It's a long period of time, but like it doesn't, and it may have fully affected their life for those 12 years, but somehow it doesn't actually feel quite, it doesn't feel major in the way that I feel like the documentary is sometimes trying to get to, which to me is also, to me that's equally interesting, because it's catching people. It's like a documentary that was made too soon, but also seems a little bit cognizant of that fact, if that makes sense.
No, I think that makes perfect sense, because if this movie was made, say, 5 years after the riots had happened in 2016, or made another 10 years from now, both films, I think, would be wildly different.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like, I find it very interesting that you have the perspective of knowing someone who participated in the riots, was expelled from their university, and then you knew them as they were trying to get their life back on track. Obviously, sort of, you know, any personal differences you may have aside, it's sort of fascinating that, you know, this person that you knew could very easily have been one of the people interviewed in this film.
I kept waiting to see if he was. And like when they showed, they had one or two anonymous interviews that I am almost certain are not that person. But like I was paying a lot of attention to the anonymous interviews just to see if I could spot, like just to see if maybe it was him. And it never was, mm-hmm. but I was a little sad about that. But like that, the filmmakers don't know me personally. They didn't ask me for interview candidates. Like, that wasn't going to happen. And I don't even know if that person would be a very interesting interview. Maybe, but it wasn't who they picked, so it's fine.
The biggest credit I will give to this film is I really appreciate it, the depth of film that they are able to get. Basically, you know, we saw every angle of this riot as it unfolded almost in real time. And all the people that ended up getting interviewed for their actions, we basically see all of them do their actions in real time, which is absolutely fascinating. I know, like, most of the footage came from CBC, which were, you know, live on the ground, and there was a little bit of social media, but like no one really had a powerful camera in 2011. So it's really interesting to sort of see how they're able to collect all of this footage and weave it in a very cohesive manner.
They have one scene of a bunch of rioters destroying a car. And the way that the movie frames it, that's the inciting incident. Like, as soon as they destroyed that car, people started rioting. Not just because that was the mood that they were getting to. And that scene of people destroying the car, I think they show it from like five different angles, which is wild because in the actual, if you think about like on the day of, that was a random thing that happened. It was an important thing, clearly. Like, it became an important thing. But, like, how do you have five different cameras on this car at different places at different times showing the same event, which ended up being really important, but at the time was just, like, a thing happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely true. Absolutely right there. I would say, in the end, my perspective of this film is always going to be of someone who, because I didn't live here when it happened, I'm never going to fully understand what people in Vancouver and the greater Vancouver area felt.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that it enhances my opinion of this film that I am basically coming to it from sort of exactly the perspective of the filmmakers. I don't know what their actual personal perspectives on this thing are, but the feeling that I get when I think of the riots is that it's something that I kind of feel like I can't comment on because I wasn't there, but I know a lot of people who were there. So I like get bits and pieces of it. And it sort of feels like, it sort of feels like that's the perspective of this movie, is looking back on it, but it's not actually far enough away that we have, you know, history textbooks or anything. And it wasn't last year. So we're not getting very fresh firsthand accounts. We're getting firsthand accounts, but like, these are people who have had 10 years to, I was going to say 10 years to think about it, but really 10 years to try and forget about it. Cause again, no one seems like they really want to remember it that much.
Yeah. Yeah. This is such a fascinating movie because it's one, like I've made pretty clear, I feel like I'm more mixed on than positive, but especially during VIFF when it played, the amount of people that were like, oh yeah, I'm curious about this movie, I'm excited about this movie. I just want other people to see it so I can listen to their perspective on it more so than just about any movie I've seen in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely I am interested in hearing other perspectives on this movie too. I didn't listen to your VIFF episode. That's what I'm going to do when I go on my walk later.
Well, thank you. We don't talk about this movie on our VIFF episode, but it was played during the festival.
Oh, okay. Well, I already promised you I was going to listen to your episode, so I'll still do that, but I'll read your review.
Sounds good. All right, next up we've got Fancy Dance, which was directed by Erica Tremblay, who is Seneca Cayuga. Do you want to give us the bit of the lowdown on this movie there, Jeff?
Yeah, I'll see if I can. This movie is actually, very interestingly, the first time I personally had seen Lily Gladstone in a movie, and the first of two times I had seen her in a movie that week. So this movie stars Lily Gladstone, and it is about a... it's actually about Lily Gladstone's character's niece, whose mother has gone missing. And because Lily Gladstone's character lives on the reservation and is sort of does odd jobs, Child Protective Services comes and takes her niece to live with her her white grandparents off the reservation. And Lily Gladstone had promised her niece that they were going to go to a powwow, which is the thing that she had always gone to with her mother, and was getting ready to go to again this year. So she goes to, technically, legally speaking, kidnap her niece and take her down to the Oklahoma powwow as promised. And most of this movie is about the road trip that they go on and sort of the trouble that sort of ends up happening around them. Because, again, legally speaking, Lily Gladstone has now kidnapped the child. But also, she is sort of on the side trying to investigate what happened to her sister, her niece's mother. Because I'm sure that people listening to this podcast know this. A woman going missing from a reservation, not a thing to take lightly.
Yeah, it's sort of tough to talk about because, you know, we now realizing the epidemic that is happening with missing and murdered Indigenous women, where too often women, especially young women, are being taken and then their bodies are just never found. Obviously, when someone is gone for a significant amount of time, the conclusion is that person has died, but they don't get the closure that they need. And so a big part of this movie is Lily Gladstone's character trying to find the closure of her sister and her niece's mother of what happened to her. I was fascinated with this one because I read your review and I don't want to mischaracterize your review at all because I think it's a very good review, but I'm watching, I was like, oh, this is way more of a thriller than I feel like Jeff was writing about in his review. You're kind of talking a lot about the politics of it all and things like that, which is very present and needs to be talked about. But I almost feel like you undersold that the thriller nature of this movie. I was sort of on the edge of my seat for a good chunk of this film.
Yeah, this was kind of interesting, especially afterwards, after I had written my review, to see what other friends of mine had said about this, because this actually played at Sundance. So I know a few people who saw it there. This movie, to me, the thing that stood out the most were the two things that stood out the most were the political messaging and then as well the relationship between sort of the road trip and that and how that characterized the relationship between Lily Gladstone's character and her niece, who's the actress of who played her. I should probably find out the name, but that's the thing that stuck out to me. But thinking back on it, yeah, it was actually like it was a real thriller. Like I remember a friend of mine described it as a murder mystery, which is not the words I would use, but is accurate, actually.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of the movie Winter's Bone, starring Jennifer Lawrence, right down to the fact that that movie takes place in the Ozarks, which is, you know, a similar region to where this movie takes place. Very similar plot line. And it also reminded me a little bit of the movie Wind River, the Taylor Sheridan movie too, which is very fascinating. And so I think if you've seen either of those movies, I think you know exactly what type of movie we're describing Fancy Dance is. But when you read sort of the byline and you look at the poster and all this sort of stuff, you really don't get that feeling that that's what this movie's going to kind of be like. It's a very split movie where I think it's a hard movie to market because it is so much a coming of age road trip movie, but it's also this thriller about trying to find a missing or murdered woman.
Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to see the director was there when I saw that, and she gave a Q&A afterwards, and she was very, very happy to be giving a Q&A to a room full of an indigenous audience, because she talked about how most of the screenings they'd given up to that point were screenings at, you know, bigger film festivals with majority white audiences who just kind of weren't familiar with the issues at play. One thing that is really important, one of the things I like a lot about this movie is the white grandma in this movie is very much she's the archetype of a person who clearly means well and thinks that she and is making what she thinks is an effort to be culturally sensitive and and to sort of connect with her granddaughter, but the way that she's doing it is actually extremely culturally insensitive, and you would not be able to explain to her why. And mm-hmm. What the director brought up is when she would screen this to other film festivals, there's always a cadre of old white women in the audience who are like, no, but Nancy is right, actually. Yeah, figures. That's the only character's name I can remember.
Yeah, I think there's a couple moments where it almost borders on being, you know, a little too comical villain-esque. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where she gives her ballet shoes and we're like, oh, forget all that powwow stuff. I'm going to sign you up for ballet. And like, that's a moment that like almost teeters on me, like, okay, you're kind of pushing a little too far of making this, you know, such an outwardly mustache twirling villain sort of aspect. But I think it's reined in a lot by Shea Whigham's character, who plays the grandfather, who is also white, which means that, his daughters are half white, half Seneca Cayuga. He sort of reins in her worst tendencies. And I think that causes just enough muddiness to be like, ooh, yeah, I guess legally they're kind of doing the right thing, but culturally they really are missing the mark here, which I thought was very fascinating.
Yeah, a really interesting component of that whole thing is I keep saying legally she is kidnapped, but it's very important and like integral to the plot that at no point does Lily Gladstone's character do anything that her niece wouldn't want her to do outside mm-hmm. of like, maybe they disagree on something, but yes. The kidnapping is actually just her taking her niece to the powwow as she promised, as her niece knows that she wants to do. And like, she asks several times, she's like, do you still want to go? And it's always fully consensual. So like a big part of this, one of the interesting conflicts of this movie is how all of the things that the movie portrays as essentially like, this is sort of a weird way to describe it, but essentially like the morally good path that this movie could take and the actions that the characters do take are also always legally wrong, but not in a way of like, this is a gangster movie. It's just like, we're going to go on a road trip, but according to the law, because of the situation we find ourselves in, legally, this is kidnapping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do a really great job of sort of treading that gray area of like where your allegiances lie. And I think Erica Tremblay did a really great job for it. And I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon yet, but as of right now, Lily Gladstone is in my top five for best actress for this part. She's having a fantastic year. I know most people are probably not going to see Fancy Dance, but I've seen Lily Gladstone before. I loved her in Certain Women, the Kelly Reichardt movie, and then she had a small bit part in another Kelly Reichardt movie, First Cow. But I'm a big fan of her, and it's so nice to see her getting all the kudos she deserves.
Yeah, and this is one that I would absolutely recommend on its own, but also for people who saw Killers of the Flower Moon and liked Lily Gladstone in that. She is as good, she's at least as good in this movie as she is in Killers of the Flower Moon, and she gets to play a much more proportionally substantial role in this movie, because she is the singular main character more than anyone. Well, mm-hmm. her and her niece.
Yes, that's true. All right, we're going to move on now to the next film, and that is called Hey Victor, which was directed by Cody Lightning, who is Cree. Hey Victor is a mockumentary about Cody Lightning is basically playing himself. He was a child actor who was in the popular, I forget what year it came out, coming of age sort of story called Smoke Signals. That was a big landmark indigenous film in the US. And, you know, 20 odd years later, he's back and he's trying to resurrect his career by making Smoke Signals 2. And so it's him with a camera crew that is following him as he is trying to, you know, get this production off the ground and also sort of reunite the original cast to come back and star in his movie. It is a mockumentary first and foremost, with a big emphasis on the mock part, because this is sort of a straight up comedy, not too dissimilar to a Christopher Guest movie, but a lot more over the top and overt with its comedy, whereas Christopher Guest's movies, I would say, are more subtle in their comedies at times. I gotta say, this is a movie I liked large portions of it. I thought the performances were excellent and everyone was really committed to the comedy, but I will say that it's hard for me to say I enjoyed a movie when I was often very frustrated with Cody the character's actions in this movie that just made me dislike him in every way. There was very little redeemable qualities up until, you know, the final 10 minutes when he sort of very predictably has his, you know, moment of clarity and realizes who he's wronged and who he's hurt, and he tries to make amends and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, things eventually come together as you'd sort of expect an archetype in a movie like this. But I think they spent too long making him so unlikable that it was hard for me to root for this film. You reviewed this film, as mentioned earlier. I'm going to link to it in the show notes, but I'd sort of love to hear your thoughts on it too.
I really wish you hadn't brought up Christopher Guest, because I hadn't even been thinking of Christopher Guest in the same, when I think of this movie, and that it's no Christopher Guest movie. So this is, I just looked up when Smoke Signals came out. It is 25 years ago, because I remember looking that up for my review, and I didn't end up having a spot to put that sentence in. But this movie, I don't know if it this movie is kind of coming out on the 25th anniversary of Smoke Signals, sort of, more or less. But yeah, I thought this movie was really funny, but it also like kind of falls apart towards the end. I don't want to say at the end, because the ending scenes are very good. But this movie to me was strongest when it could really commit to the like faux documentary format. But then by the end, it's a mockumentary in like name only. There's a few scenes, which obviously the whole movie is scripted, but with a mockumentary, I think what works so well about Christopher Guest mockumentaries as well is that like nothing feels super scripted, even if it is, I don't know. But like, it does feel like a documentary the whole way through, even during the most ridiculous moments. It's like, oh, it's a documentary of very ridiculous people, I guess. But in this movie, there's a couple of scenes, like a lot of the more emotional scenes near the end with Cody Lightning and Simon Baker, and also his manager, who I believe her name was Kelly or something. Anyway, a bunch of the like scenes where he's making up to different people feel, they don't even have like that kind of documentary camera work or anything. They just, there is nominally a camera person there and he is acting out a scene, which is, you know, him redeeming himself to his character, to a different character. It's fine, but it sort of drops that illusion of documentary that's really integral to mockumentary. And I think that's sort of where it lost me a bit at the end.
Yeah, that's fair. I think for me, it was just the sort of unredeemable aspects of his character that were just, I'm just not a fan of that style of performance. and I struggle with it. That said, I think there's some really funny scenes. Like there's a couple of scenes where Cody uses nudity, his own nudity, to great comedic effect, including a scene where after going on a complete bender, wakes up the next day and his manager finds he had drawn using his own feces on the window, and you see him, he's still covered in shit and he's naked, and you see him fully naked and she hoses him down. It's a hilarious scene, and I super applaud the fact that he is so willing to commit to this bit. But it's that's the problem, is like all these funny bits that individually I like, kind of like how you watch a Borat movie where you're like, oh yeah, a lot of this is really reprehensible, but you take it apart and I enjoy all these individual moments. But, you know, as a whole, I find it really lacked for me, unfortunately.
Actually, you mentioning that, there's another scene where they need a scene in their movie that they're shooting where one of the characters throws a baby out a window. And so he just walks into frame. Like, you don't know where he's been for the last 10 minutes. And he just comes in holding a baby that he, like, paid someone $20 if he could like watch her baby for a few minutes. And scenes like that, and the scene that you just mentioned, to me, like that's, I wouldn't mind so much Cody being kind of irredeemable if the rest of the movie had sort of fit around that as well, because I think in the beginning of the movie, like the first third of the movie, as well as bits like that, give it like sort of an Always Sunny feeling to it. And mm-hmm. that the rest of the movie doesn't quite commit to. Like, Simon Baker is very good in this movie, but he's very much the emotional core that the rest of the movie kind of has to live up to eventually. And I think that as much as his scenes with Cody Lightning work really well, they're tonally just different enough from the stuff at the beginning that eventually the movie has to choose. And I don't know that it makes the right choice at the end.
Yeah, if this was a 30-minute film, I could handle all the irredeemable aspects of his character, and I think it would work fine. But at over an hour and a half, it's an hour and 40 minutes, I really felt the length.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, I think that a lot of, like, where I'm saying at the beginning, too, that it sort of drops that suspension of disbelief for a documentary also is mostly a result of the length more than anything else, because all of the scenes that I felt like didn't feel real the way the rest of the movie did. And like, none of this movie feels that real, but the ones that like, where even in my suspension of disbelief, I'm like, I don't know if I buy that. Those all happen near the end when it's very important to the character arc he's been on that he gets a little bit of a redemption at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you've seen Smoke Singles before, you probably enjoy this movie. It's a interesting experiment in comedy, but I think, unfortunately, we're both saying it doesn't ultimately work. Let us move on to our last film, and that's, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Tautuktavuk, What We See. If you want to, which was directed by Carol Canuck and Lucy Tulugariuk, who are both Inuit. So if you want to kind of talk briefly about what this movie is.
Oh, this is a really hard one to describe. I really love this movie, but this is a movie, you know, when you're trying to describe a movie, you're usually, like, at least me, I'm usually trying to hone in on the plot. And this movie almost doesn't have a plot. Like, it's, this movie is about the two directors, I believe. Who did you say they were? Carol Canuck and
Lucy Tulugariuk. Yes, they play the two main characters.
Yes, who are very loosely, they're like, I think they're both playing fictionalized versions of themselves. Or if they're not, they're extremely, like, they're barely fictional characters. Well, they're supposed to be essentially who they are. I think one of them is, I think Carol Canuck is actually playing Carol Canuck.
Yeah.
Anyway, point being, they're playing two Inuit women during COVID who are dealing with basically the after effects of a lifetime of being around abuse and alcoholism and not talking about it. Like, that's essentially what this movie is them and one or two other characters sort of learning to talk about these abusive situations they've been in that they may not have even recognized as abusive because they never had anyone to talk to about them. And that's like the whole movie. There's some really, really, this movie hit a lot of people in the audience really hard because it's just a movie about, you know, about people finally having a voice despite their entire lives not being allowed to do that. And it's hard for me to describe this movie in much more detail without, you know, bringing it into the discussion, which we will do, because in service of that, like, the main plot points are one character starts going to therapy and starts talking to her sister about it. Another character goes to Montreal because she was going to do that anyway. But while she's there, she visits with her grandchildren. Eventually, all three of the main characters end up back in Igloolik and hang out. Like, there isn't much plot to this movie, which makes it very difficult to describe.
Yeah, I would say sort of the setup is very interesting because it basically the first two thirds of the movie is mostly communicated to us through Zoom conversations between these two sisters. So it's very interesting that we sort of get this very naturalistic feel where we're just eavesdropping on a conversation where we understand bits and pieces of what they're talking about because it's a continuation from their previous conversation. But then they're also talking about stuff and people that we have no knowledge about or never really brought up again. So because of that, it has a real fly on the wall feel to these conversations that is utterly realistic and totally believable. Like the amount that they're able to sell these Zoom calls, and they don't hide that they're Zoom calls at all. And so it's really fascinating that I am so impressed by how much work they put in to make this movie not look like a movie, which sounds weird, but like this movie looks like it was shot on a handheld camcorder that was, you know, 15, 20 years old. The quality is not great. They only use naturalistic lighting. The framing is never really perfect. It's sort of like you kind of get what you get. You're not really sure. Some people are cut off a little bit. You don't really know what's going on. And then you get these Zoom calls where it's just literally cropping from the screen that it's being done as. And you're just like, what is this movie? And then like before you know it, you sort of fall under this spell of, I am in these women's world. I know what's going on in their lives. And as they're kind of sharing more stories, you're just like, oh my God, I totally understand what is happening right now. And it's not clear at the start, but when that realization hits you of what these women are going through, it just sort of blows your mind.
So I was just talking about in Hey Victor, how eventually like it sort of played too much with my suspension of disbelief where I couldn't really buy it as a fake documentary at a certain point. This one, I had to keep reminding myself that this is in fact not a documentary because it felt so naturalistic and so real. And to a very large degree, I think that the people involved with this movie were telling stories that were like sort of a Nomadland thing. They're telling stories that are actually real, even though the scenes are scripted, to the point where like this movie, I don't know how else to say it. It just feels like a documentary. It feels so real, this movie. And it is, it's getting to the heart of something very real. I think when they, when the Q&A for this happened, they said that one or two of the scenes were just, I'm pretty sure they said my favorite scene was just a scene that they happened to pick up with someone who wasn't acting. She was just actually saying something.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it really helps that the two stars are also the two directors, and they probably had so many conversations about how they want to frame and shape this movie that when it came time to act these scenes out, that A, they already have a professional and working relationship with each other so much that they can pretend that they're sisters. And two, they know exactly what needs to get done to advance the plot from point A to B to C, that everything sort of falls into place very naturalistically. And we get information revealed to us at the right moment. It never sort of feels like, you know, oh, they're stringing us along and here's an information dump. It really does sort of feel like breadcrumbs connecting the dots along the way.
The most interesting thing to me at the Q&A for this is that they described a completely different movie. They described how this movie was when they had conceptualized it. And, you know, they were just getting ready to start filming it, and then COVID happened. So they had to improvise and figure out a completely different identity for this movie, because one of them was in Igloolik and the other one was in Montreal. They just couldn't get back together to film this in Igloolik like they'd wanted to. And the movie they described was much more narratively driven and included a lot of scenes that we don't even get in this movie. We barely even, like, you could completely miss them because they are like things that informed a conversation but aren't really told about. Like, someone dies apparently at the beginning of this movie, and I'm not 100% sure if that's actually even still an event that necessarily happens in the movie that we got, but it was a big part of the original vision for this movie, and it was one of the things they were dealing with, was this character dying and it potentially being a different character's fault. And that different character, the first time we would have been introduced to her, was drunk at a party using all sorts of, you know, camera tricks to make it look like the audience themselves are drunk, like a whole thing. And they described this movie, and I'm like, it's really interesting that they have this whole context and that they envisioned this story as something else. And it's even more interesting that they didn't get to make that movie and instead made this other thing, which is clearly informed by a context that we only get a little bit of.
Wow. That's really fascinating. I'll say that if it wasn't for Blackberry, this would be my number one Canadian movie of the year. It is so fascinating.
Yeah, I think this was, this is either this or Fancy Dance are my favorites from this festival. And I think that this one is, I think this is the one that I'm rating more highly in my mind, just that Fancy Dance is a little easier to watch twice.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. All right. We're going to move on to the last section where you're just kind of share some thoughts about two movies that you saw, Red, White, and Brass and Inky, Pinky, Ponky, which were both directed by Damon Fepulilai, who is Tongan. I apologize. I'm sure I pronounced Damon's name wrong, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on those two films.
These are movies that I probably would not have enjoyed very much watching them alone at home, but they were probably my favorite experiences at this festival. Because both of these movies are very much about Tongan identity, where neither of them, like, they're very much about Tongan identity, and it plays an extremely important part of the role in each movie. And but that's also not all they're about. Red, White, and Brass is about, I believe, the 2012 Rugby World Championship in New Zealand. There was a game. Between one of the early games was between Tonga and France, and it's about a small Tongan community in Wellington who wants to get enough money for their whole church to go and see the Tonga versus France rugby game. And in order to do that, they decide to all learn to be a marching band. And it's very, I would say that, like, in terms of most of the elements of this movie, it's very much a just like, kind of run-of-the-mill feel-good movie with it's got fun characters. None of them are like that special, but they're well enough acted, and it feels like a really, really fun just a little bit higher budget than a TV movie. With Inky, Pinky, Ponky as well, that is a character, that's a movie originally done as a play, which is about a trans woman going to Tongan trans woman going to a Catholic school and sort of, you know, dealing with the fact that she's in a Catholic school and no one there likes her. So she has to show that, you know, she's actually the coolest person in the school and it's all about going to prom eventually. So like neither of these is exactly like a super high stakes movie. But what I liked about these is the Tongan identity really plays into it, for one thing. Both of them are an extremely large plot point is how much they are Tongans in New Zealand and how much that plays into, like, specifically those family dynamics are basically the heart of both movies. And the reason this was the funnest experience I had at Imaginative was the entire audience was just... I'm pretty sure it was all Tongans. I don't know for sure, because, but I know that it was all Pacific Islanders, and they were having a blast. People were actually hooting and hollering during both of these movies. I think one person, like, didn't get up, but was, like, screaming along with one of the dances they do at the end of Red, White, and Brass, which was wild. I've never had an experience like that in a theater.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I've seen a couple of years ago when I covered Imaginative, I saw The Legend of Baron Toa, which is another Tongan film from New Zealand. And the energy that you get from Tongan cinema and Kiwi cinema is just so different than what we're used to, where comedy is obviously the preemptive language that they use. And it really sort of shows. I'm sad I missed that experience because that sounds absolutely insane to watch in person. I did watch Red, White, and Brass. I mixed on the movie overall, but I did think it was still a fun one nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, that's what I'm saying. With Red, White, and Brass and Inky, Pinky, Ponky, I thought they were both good enough. Like they were both fine. I don't know that I would have gotten anything out of watching them, you know, as a screener or in literally any other context. Like being in an audience where being in a theater with an audience who is seeing themselves represented on screen and knows everything about this culture that is, you know, not something I'm a part of, and like is clearly having the time of their lives watching this is my favorite thing about a smaller film festival, and especially this one.
Nice. Good to hear. All right. Well, then I think that's a good place to sort of wrap up. Do you have any final thoughts on either any of the movies we talked about or any that we didn't?
I think we pretty much talked about everything that I saw. The only other movie that I saw that we didn't talk about is Muru, which stars Cliff Curtis and is about a Maori raid that a raid on a Maori village that I believe happened in 2017. It's pretty cool. It's very tense. It's a pretty cool action movie. It's one that I would absolutely recommend, but I also feel like my main weakness going into it is that I did not know more of the context. And I think that that's one that, it's a movie that specifically exists to bring awareness to this thing that happened that was pretty awful. But I think it would really help to know more about that thing first. So I think if anyone is listening to this and of the movies we have not talked about, see if you are able to find Muru. And if you are, look up what it's about and like, try and do a little bit of research into it first, because I think you will enjoy it a lot more. And it's very cool. It's worth watching.
Fair enough. All right. Well, you can read Jeff's reviews of Hey Victor and Fancy Dance, along with Late Night with the Devil and more at ContraZoomPod.com. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Jeff. What do you wish to promote and where can people find you?
So people can find us mainly on Spotify, Classic Movies Live. We just put out an episode on we had Bhavna from the Bloody Broads on to talk about Mad Max Fury Road, which was awesome. That's probably one of our longest episodes in a while, too. And we have a project coming up. We have a project coming up that's starting as our next episode. So it should be. Might even be the day after this episode that we're recording right now, me and you, comes out, that I'm very excited about. I have mentioned it here and there on our show and also on guest appearances, but I don't think I've ever fully said what the project is. So I'm very excited for people to hear about it, because it's something that the first episode was great, and I'm excited for the next 60, however many it is. It's a lot.
Well, very excited to hear more about that and check it out.
And otherwise, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, Jeff. This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. Did you see anything at Imaginative? Let us know your thoughts. Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smale for the theme music and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on Ko-fi. Thanks for checking us out.